The reading is from the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed. We are all dying, our lives always moving toward completion. We need to learn to live with death and to understand that death is not the worst of all events. We need to fear not death, but life, empty lives, lives that do not build upon the gifts that each of us has been given, lives that are living deaths, lives which we never take the time to savor and appreciate, lives in which we never pause to breathe deeply. What we need to fear is not death, but squandering the lives we have been miraculously given. So let me die laughing, savoring one of life's crazy moments. Let me die holding the hand of one I love and recalling that I tried to love and was loved in return. Let me die remembering that life has been good and that I did what I could. But today, just remind me that I am dying so that I can live, savor, and love with all my heart.
My interest in and embracing of causes has always followed my own ages and stages and whatever life issue I was dealing with at the time. I am very interested these days in end-of-life issues. In our Time to Talk discussion back in 2017, we learned that while most of us do not believe we are going home to the arms of Jesus... To continue, or to discover a heaven or a hell, or any sort of afterlife at all, but at the same time, others of us believe in reincarnation, in ghosts and spirits, the possibility of something, or just in the vast mystery of life and death. So in keeping with the theme of emergence this month, I would like to suggest that new views are emerging around death. As UUs, we've been on the cutting edge of changing how our culture deals with death. I think there's still a role for us to play in continuing that change.
Skip it.
Okay. When you go home, Google Coffin Club, the New Zealand Coffin Club on YouTube. You'll love it. So, during my brief stint as a home birth midwife in the mid-80s, I encountered the writing of Barbara Ehrenreich in Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, A History of Women Healers. I even attended a workshop she led in Edmonton in the 1980s. Dr. Ehrenreich, a PhD in cellular biology, veered from the academic path and went on to write many books about healthcare and medical science, feminism, and even religion. In fact, some of you might like a book called Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer Search for the Truth About Everything. I've always admired her. So when I heard about her latest book, Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer, I knew I had to read it. One of the things that evolved from my career as a midwife was discovering while attending my mother's dying how much like midwifery that felt. Instead of midwifing a life, I was midwifing a death. Ehrenreich's book turned out to be hard slogging, not because of the topic, but because it was a short course in cell biology. I doubt you want to hear a whole lot about your telomeres, how they're shortening even as we speak, or how your macrophages are aiding and abetting inflammation and even cancer, where once we thought they were really important cleanup tools in our body. They do that, but they also aid and abet inflammation. to the point that someone has coined the term inflammaging. That is what is doing us in. And there can be no denying that our individual genetics will play a role too. The bottom line, our bodies are programmed to self-destruct. Our mortality, of course, leads us to the deep philosophical questions. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Mary Lou kindly shared her thoughts for my presentation, and this is something she wrote several years ago. Once upon a time, you got old, or sick, or had an accident, and you died. And people were either sad or pleased by your demise. It might be a theological issue, why have the gods done this? But it would not be a moral or an ethical one. But when human beings began to investigate ways of prolonging their lives, the moral and ethical questions began. If death is God's will, is it up to us to decide who shall live and who shall die? What is a natural death? When we alleviate pain, are we doing God's will? Or does suffering lead to heaven? Just because we can prolong life, are we obliged to do that? If we choose to end our lives, is that a criminal act or a personal choice? Who decides for those who are unable to choose? Are humans playing God when they save lives? And in the end, what is life and what is death? That's the end of the quote from Mary Lou's writing. Erin Wright begins her book telling us about her gradual realization that she was old enough to die. At 76, she decided to go against the grain of her demographic. I realized I was old enough not to incur any more suffering, annoyance, or boredom in the pursuit of a longer life. I eat well, meaning I choose foods that taste good and stave off hunger for as long as possible, like protein and fiber and fats. I exercise not because it will make me live longer, but because it feels good when I do. That's a personal choice. As for medical care, I will seek help for an urgent problem, but I am no longer interested in looking for problems that remain undetectable to me. Ideally, the determination of when one is old enough to die should be a personal decision based on a judgment of the likely benefits, if any, of medical care, and just as important at a certain age, how we choose to spend the time that remains to us. End quote. She is certainly backed up in this stance by an increasing awareness of and evidence for the problems of routine screening, false positives and intrusive procedures that can cause their own bad effects. For example, both mammograms and prostate screening result in things being done, they pick up on cancers that are so slow growing, the patient may well die before the cancer can get them. The book, Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health, by H. Gilbert Welch, is a good source of information on this topic. Another one that comes to mind is one called Selling Sickness. Have you noticed that your family doctor, if you have one, doesn't schedule annual exams anymore? In fact, if you call and ask for one, they don't even seem to know what you're talking about. And that's because there's a definite undercurrent in society against the medicalization of dying. Quoting Erin Wright again, "In giving up on preventative care, I'm just taking this thinking a step further. Not only do I reject the torment of a medicalized death, but I refuse to accept a medicalized life. And my determination only deepens with age. Being old enough to die is an achievement, not a defeat. And the freedom it brings is worth celebrating." She goes on to say, "Many people who got caught up in the health craze of the late 20th century, people who exercised, watched what they ate, abstained from smoking and heavy drinking, have nevertheless died." Some of you, I'm sure, would remember the Dick Cavett show and the crazy thing that happened one time when he was taping. Jeremy Rodale, the founder of Prevention Magazine, died of a heart attack at 72 while taping the Dick Cavett Show, having just moments before announced that he had decided to live to be 100. One of the things I love about you, Yus, is our ability to face death head on with little denial and a lot of pragmatism. Here's just some of the many things we discussed during our Time to Talk series in 2017. Death cafes. These are get-togethers that people are having in many cities all over to talk about death. There's a Death Matters group in town that also does this sort of thing. They were meeting at Just Us Cafe, but that's closed now, isn't it? Anyway, they also offer some short courses. We talked about green burial, which is the idea that you just get wrapped in a shroud and laid in the earth in some natural preserve. And it only has to be 3 feet down, not 6 feet down, if you're doing that. And then you're at the right level for all the organisms to work on your body and turn it back into dust. And of course, this is really important in terms of ecology, because the carbon footprint of cremation or full body burial is just huge. We talked about death doulas, and that's a really big movement right now. People are taking training for it, and they're there either for the person who is dying or the family of the dying person to assist them through that process. There are threshold choirs who go to sing at the bedside of a dying person. I think there's one on Cape Breton. And hospice, of course, and home funerals. There's lots of support for that now, and instruction on how to pack the body in liquid nitrogen, or dry ice rather, so that you can keep them for 2 or 3 days, like the old Irish wake, you know, on the kitchen table until you have the celebration. We talked about writing your own will, your advanced personal directive, your own order of service, and your own obit. Have any of you actually done your homework from that session? There were a lot of people that attended. And did you know that Reverend Norm would be very pleased to have any document that you wish to produce with your last wishes on file here so that we can access that when we need it? I very ridiculously read the obits every day, or skim them, even though I'm a come from away and can't really expect to see names of people I know. But sometimes there's a real gem, and I clip it out just in case we ever do Time to Talk again. So here's a little bit from one of those columns. First of all, this was a full-length, full-page column in the Herald a month ago, which you sometimes see for famous people or doctors or, you know, somebody who's really, you know, got the Nobel Prize or something. This man was a grave digger. And it's just wonderful. He was a self-directed man who operated his own business for decades, worked all along the Eastern Shore. His main occupation was excavation, of which he was most famous for his grave digging. He dug his first grave at age 14, and over a period of 53 years, he estimated that he buried 3,000 people in graves all the way from Dartmouth to Tangier. Burial will take place in Lake Charlotte Union Church Cemetery, Clam Bay Road. The reason Oliver chose this graveyard was because it is one of the best graveyards to dig in. Not many rocks, lots of sand with good drainage and not much water. When Oliver got married at the age of 59, it stood to reason that he should have a huge wedding with the whole neighborhood invited. Being a modest man, he stated that if it happened, he wouldn't be there. As a result, there were only 11 people at the wedding, and he was one of them. His funeral, on the other hand, may prove to include many more than 11 people, Today the world is a different place for the loss of such a kind, gentle man. It's lovely, isn't it? So, as far as I'm concerned, one of the things that you use do best is celebrations of life. I think we've really led the way in showing others how to do this. I will never forget the funeral of a colleague of mine, the service of a colleague of mine from the Edmonton Adoption Community. We were both members of the Edmonton Unitarian Church at the time. And because of her work, the church was full of outsiders. I was never so proud to be a UU, and I remember the people afterwards raving about the service. But I was also very proud of Reverend John Marsh, as I stood with him at Sharon's bedside just days before her death, while he told her what she had meant to the world. 3 years later, when my mother died, I applied all that I knew about celebrating a life to her United Church service. And afterwards, one of the ministers told me, "The people of this town really needed to see what you did here today." And I'm like, "Really? Like, why wouldn't everybody do it this way?" I continue to believe that memorial services are one of the things we do best. And as your lay chaplain, it was a highlight and a privilege for me to officiate last June at Lorna Mitchell's service. And this June, I'm going to Charlottetown to do Bunty Albert's service. Back to Time to Talk. We also had a guest speaker from Dying with Dignity. And of course, medical assistance in dying is a big topic these days and is happening right across the country, but there's glitches with the legislation, as you probably know. And here again, the Unitarians have played a role. The CUC has been interveners on several of the court challenges that have happened with cases over the years, and they're doing it again shortly, I believe, as we try to get the legislation to address some of the things that it left out. It is an increasingly secular world, and I believe that UUism is showing the way to be spiritual but not religious, to be accepting of one's mortality, to celebrate a life with tears and laughter, with ritual, or a party. Marie Davis is going to have a party. There'll be a party here for her, no service. And to go gently into that good night, even without any expectation of an hereafter. I have a lovely story to end with, and you may be glad to know I'm ending. This happened quite by serendipity this past week. I took my granddaughter to hear Jane Goodall speak on Tuesday night. And she turned 85 this month, Jane did. She spoke for the first hour without notes and without stopping. And then the second hour was like in an interview format with the CEO of the Jane Goodall Institute Canada, showing slides and asking Jane questions about her life. The last question was, "What is your next big adventure?" And Jane said, "Death. I think death will be my next big adventure. There may be nothing, and that's fine. Or there may be something, and that would be an amazing adventure."